it's really just the same. We're always looking out with a puzzled kind of grin, but perhaps we'd all do better looking in. So next time you go to your window, don't just sit there, just open it wide.
Listening to The Zombies here on Come to the Sunshine, and I'm your host, Andrew Sandoval. In this last set of music from The Zombies, and more correctly, The Zombies and Colin Blunstone, we heard How We Were Before, one of Colin's tracks that he wrote for a Zombies single. Beechwood Park, written by Chris White for the Odyssey and Oracle LP, was the UK mono mix. We also heard an Old Grey Whistle Test performance of Colin performing Tim Rose's Misty Roses on December 14th, 1971. That was issued in 1995 on the Windsong Colin Blunstone at the BBC CD release. We also heard a very rare mono mix, the original single mix of World of Glass, The Call-In issued under the name Neil MacArthur. That was written by producer Mike Hurst. And that was Darum 45, number DM-225, issued on January 10th, 1969. And we closed out the set with I Can't Live Without You from Call-In's just transcendent and beautiful one-year LP. If you're a Zombies fan and you've never heard or purchased One Year, please do that now. It was produced by Chris and Rod of Nexus Productions.
Can you dance with silver moon steps on the love couch of the sand? I will sing and play a fairy reel upon the swan-eared lute. A tale of silver sandals of an elf who loved to fish. For the twinkles in the evening waves with an oaken dish. As you skip and spin and reel, can you loose thy velvet band and send thy mane a-tossing to the kissing of the moon? Bid me enter, thine eyes will open love to the allness of the smallness and the starry sky above. Thy velvet band and send thy mane a tossing to the kissing of the moon.
And now we're going to go back in time to the first Zombies recording, Summertime.
Colin, I wonder if, just as a sort of starting off point, you could tell us how you got into the entertainment business. Was it something you always wanted to do, or not?
No, it just sort of happened, really. We were very silly. We just gave up our jobs and went in. When I look back on it now, it's ridiculous how we did it. We just made a record, gave up our jobs, and there we were.
The Zombies were, in fact, together as a group while you were all at school?
Yeah, for about three years, just playing very locally. We'd never travelled more than about 7 miles.
Looking back on it, though, would you have done it any other way, do you think?
No, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
It's summertime, and the living is easy. The fields are jumping, and the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich, and your mama's good looking. Won't you hush, pretty baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're gonna wake up singing. Then you're gonna spread your wings and take to the sky. But till that morning, there ain't nothing gonna harm you. With your mommy and daddy there standing by. Don't you cry.
I think we've made mistakes afterwards,
yeah.
Sort of since, but up till then, I think, as it worked out, it was okay.
The kind of girl who says to me she doesn't want my love is not the kind of girl that you tell me I should be thinking of. Share with me all of the pleasures that you've enjoyed. But don't you think that you're forgiven for taking her away? For if it hadn't been for your deceit, I'd be holding her today. You think you've got everything just because you hold her in your arms. Squeeze her tight. Don't you understand that she runs away with anyone who happens in her sight? Oh, you can see how hot she is. You think you're very wise, but she will run away from you before you realize. Got everything just because you hold her in your arms and squeeze her tight. Don't you understand that she runs away with anyone who happens in her sight? Oh, you can see how hard she is. You think you're very wise, but she will run away from you.
You've had a fair degree of success and earned a considerable amount of repute. What do you think of the mistakes you've made?
Well, I think we made the hits and we didn't follow them up.
Mm-hmm.
That was a snag. Publicity and continual plugging and really working at the building up an image. People should know what you look like, what you do and everything, and we haven't really worked hard enough at that.
Told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked. She had tanned the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool. Her eyes were clear and bright. But she's not there. Well, no one told me about her. What could I do? Well, no one told me about. Should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had turned the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. She's not there.
What about records, by and large? Do you think they've been right or wrong?
Some of them I haven't been happy with myself. In some ways, I think that we play them better on stage. Whether you like us on stage or not, it's, of course, entirely a personal matter.
Yeah.
But I think we play them better on stage than the record themselves, you know.
If it seems that I'm too quiet, that's 'cause I'm missing her. My mind tells me I have to fight, but I can't help missing her. You better leave me alone. You better leave me alone until I can think about her without feeling sorry for myself. You'd better leave me be till I don't need her anymore. I don't wanna meet her again until I'm sure I'm over her. But myself, feeling tired and wanting, it's not like I thought it would be. Love just cannot end that parting. My world's dropped from under me. You better leave me alone. You better leave me alone until I can think about her without feeling sorry for myself.
In spite of your success in America, the Zombies have not achieved the same kind of success in Britain, have they?
No, no.
Does this lead at all to any feeling of despondency?
Occasionally, yes. I think everybody in show business is very prone to get depressed.
But we're all volatile, agree.
Yeah,
but, I mean,
yeah.
If you can't see a big thing coming your way, does it ever lead you to feel, let's give it all up?
Sometimes, yes, I must admit. I'm a very moody type person.
Mm.
But I just have to sort of get out of the mood and think. You know, I think we've got the potential.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we've shown we've got the potential.
Sure.
And yeah. I think we can do it just as well again.
You don't need any reason, do you, baby? Oh, surely you should know that by now. So good, so good, so good. Never thought could be so good to me. So good, so good. Never thought could be so good to me.
You don't need any reason, do you, baby? Oh no. Surely you should know that by now.
It's The Zombies. Here on Come to the Sunshine, I'm your host, Andrew Sandoval. We just heard five primal slices of the band, including their original demo recording of Summertime, issued for the first time in 1997 on the Big Beat Zombies box set Zombie Heaven, written by Gershwin, Gershwin, Hayward, and Hayward. That was followed by Kind of Girl, issued on the Zombies UK EP on January 29th, 1965, Decca EP number DFE-8598, written by Rod and produced by Marquis Enterprises. We also heard their hit single, She's Not There, issued on July 24th, 1964, written by Rod, Decca 45, number F11940. And that was followed by Leave Me Be, the less than successful follow-up. That was the U.S. remix for the Parrot 45, number 9723, written by Chris and produced by Marquis Enterprises, directed by Ken Jones. We also heard one of my favorites, You Make Me Feel Good, issued on the flip of She's Not There in July of 64, Decca 45, number 11940, written by Rod and covered by many, many people. We're running out of time, so I just want to get back to the music. Here's the demo version of I Know She Will.
I know this girl, and I know you well. You want her now, she needs you now. Just take her hand, she'll go with you. Warm to her, she'll be your world. No matter where you go, no matter what you do, she'll be for you. I know she will, I know she will.
Love me. What's your name? Is your daddy? Is he rich like me? Has he taken us any time
to show?
What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Is he rich like me? Has he taken any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
You've been listening to the Come to the Sunshine Artist Spotlight on The Zombies. In this last set of music, we heard the demo version of I Know She Will, issued by Big Beat, on the 1999 reissue of Begin Here, written by Rod Argent, and the song was later redone for the RIP sessions. We also heard Time of the Season, the original UK mono LP mix from Odyssey and Oracle, CBS LP number 63280, written by Rod, who also composed It's All Right with Me. Great track there. And now, a few more songs just to say goodbye. Don't go too far away. We'll be back with more Come to the Sunshine someday soon.
Running out. Hold on. on if you must. But time's never been a friend. Time's been running out since time began. You must change with time, or time will change your love. While you've been standing still, everything else will have grown. The answer's easy,
the answer's easy.
If you try,
if you really try,
the answer's right. Answers why. Don't try to hold the waves back. Don't try too hard to fly. For time is running out, and time never lies. Is easy,
the answer's easy.
If you try,
if you only try,
the answer's right.
Answer's right.
The answer's why. Don't try to hold the waves back. Don't try to hide your fly. Time is running out, and time never lies.
Well, I'm going home to see my woman, and I'm going home to see my girl. Oh, don't you know? She really loves me. Oh, don't you know? She really cares. Yes, I'm gone home.
I did. up to say all I said was true. So please don't laugh, oh please don't run. Listen when I say, talked of me, but far more of you, which makes me wonder now.
To be in a band ever since I was about 13 years old, 12 or 13 years old, because I had a cousin who's 4 years older than me, and in fact in the end I ended up playing with him in Argent. He was a bass player in Argent, Jim Rodford, and he formed one of the first bands in this area called the Blue Tones. And the Blue Tones had the first electric guitar in this area, as far as I know, I mean in within about 100 miles. You know, a sort of early Fender came over, and this was their pride and joy. I went to see them play one of their local gigs live, and I thought it was brilliant. And from that point onwards, I just wanted to be in a band, really. I suppose I must have been 15. I wandered into a classroom at school. I went to a school in St. Albans called St. Albans School. And there was this guy playing acoustic guitar, and I thought he sounded really good. That guy, I didn't know, but it turned out to be Paul Atkinson. And I just walked up to him while I was waiting for my friend and said, you don't know me, you know, my name's Rod. I'm really looking to start a band. I wondered if you'd be interested. He said, yeah, all right, okay. So I had a guitarist. Then I thought, right, now we need to get the other guy. So one of my best friends at the time was a guy called Paul Arnold. I went to see Paul that evening, and I knew that he was building a bass guitar. Now, I also knew he couldn't play a note of any instrument and never had in his life, but I knew he was building a bass guitar. So I said, well, I know, how's the bass guitar going? He said, well, you know, it's nearly finished. I said, great. I said, well, would you like to play it in a band? He said, yeah, all right. He said, I've got a friend who sings and plays a bit of guitar. He said, we could get him involved if you like. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. What's his name? He said, well, Colin Blunstone. I said, okay. And I thought, right, what we need now is a drummer. So one of the things that we had at St. Norman's School was an army corps. I knew that on the Friday that was coming up, they had their army corps day. So I stood outside while the army corps went by, and I looked for the guy who seemed to have the most rhythm playing the drums, side drum. And that was Hugh Grundy. So I collared him afterwards and said, would you like to be in a band? He said, yeah, why not? I said, okay, first rehearsal, we meet outside the Blacksmith's Arms, which was a pub in St. Albans, next Friday evening, 7 o'clock. Okay, yeah, all right. Now I had a band, but we had no instruments or no equipment. So I went to my cousin, Jim Rodford, and said, could we borrow all the Blue Tones equipment for this rehearsal? He very kindly organised all this. The Blue Tones used to rehearse at a youth club called the Pioneer Youth Club. So we commandeered the Pioneer for the following Friday evening, met outside the Blacksmith's Arms, which was literally only 200 yards away from the Pioneer Club, and we were away. Hugh set up the Blue Tones drum kit with a kick drum, you know, a snare, some cymbals, a couple of tom-toms. And it was extraordinary because he had really natural coordination. Within an hour, I'd say, he could get the coordination of hands and feet together and he could play simple drum feels, which was brilliant, really. I was really impressed with everybody. I mean, it was a real buzz that first rehearsal and it just all fell into place. And in fact, that became the Zombies, apart from the bass player. I mean, that was the only change. And he was actually, to be fair to Paul, he was thinking at the time that he really wanted to be a doctor, you know, so he followed that route. And we got in touch with Chris White, who became the bass player. But apart from that, that first rehearsal became the Zombies. And the combination of being very naive, never having been in bands before, which gave us really quite a fresh way of looking at things, I think, and the incredible luck of everyone actually being talented was just brilliant. The group actually did form in 1961, but there was a period of obviously quite a long time before we could actually get gigs, before we could actually move forward. I mean, in a way, that was the most exciting time of all that I've had in music, because the actual buzz of getting people together and suddenly, even in the smallest way, being part of this whole scene, and with the Beatles first starting to open everything up, was just brilliant. Like most bands, I think we started playing covers, covers being other people's tunes. We had to get a set together, obviously. The first priority was to be able to play for at least 45 minutes, because without that, we couldn't get any gigs. So the first tunes that we would do would be Cliff Richard tunes, Shadows tunes, instrumentals, anything from Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis things. Although I will say that we always looked for the more obscure Elvis things. We really rehearsed, I guess, we just practiced really at a youth club in Hatfield. And in fact, it was next door to where one of the masters at my school lived who hated rock and roll music. And we must have put him through hell, you know, his Sunday afternoons, his time of peace, you know, was a time of peace no more. Eventually we thought, well, we've been rehearsing and rehearsing, we've got to try and get a gig. So Colin said, well, I play for my school rugby team. They have a dance every month. It's got a dance band, but I might be able to persuade them that we could, in the interval, they won't give us any money, but we might be able to play 20 minutes, you know, in the interval. We said, yeah, it'd be fantastic, you know. So we trekked down to this Old Relamium's rugby club. The dance band finished their first set. There were maybe 40 people there in the place. It was very quiet. And we set up our stuff and we played. And it went down a storm. And it went so well, in fact, that they said, well, come and do it again next month, which we did. Next month, there were maybe twice the amount of people there, about 80 people. And they said, well, this is great. Maybe we could set up a gig with just you playing as the main band. We said, fantastic. We'll have to rehearse a lot more, you know. So we rehearsed some more and they set up a gig for us a couple of months later and we played, and there were maybe 200 people there, which was great. And it was really started to get a reputation and atmosphere. So much so that we played there, I reckon, that was our main gig for a while. And over a period of maybe, I don't know, 18 months, we built up that place. And in the end, they had to have a marquee attached to the place to get all the people in. And that was very exciting times, actually. And then we started to play also at my school's old boys association, which was rugby club, which was called the OAs, and we played there and we built up a similar sort of thing there. And then obviously we had to move out. We had to move to wider pastures, you know. I remember the first gig, which was quite frightening to do, was a local youth club. That went very well. And then we got the big chance, we thought, which was the St. Ormond's Town Hall, to play backup for one of the famous semi-pro groups of the time. I can't even remember who they were. We got up there and we had a local promoter who was coming to see us to see how good we were. Now, there were two new elements in the Town Hall gig. First of all, it was by far the biggest place we'd ever played. And we had no idea of the problems that bad acoustics can give you. Secondly, because it was ages before the main band was on, there was nobody there. So there were about three people in the hall, this huge high ceiling. The sound threw us completely because it just sounded echoey and thin. And the promoter was there and we were mortified. I mean, we thought it was awful. We thought it was just terrible. And we thought, well, he's the local promoter. He's not going to give us any gigs. But for whatever reason, he saw through that and he actually did give us a gig, one of the local sort of gigs, and he booked us on trust, you know, for a main thing. It was the Bolito Hosiery Mills, and we did a gig there, and it was fantastic. It was really good. It went down a storm, and we started becoming very popular on the live circuit. I think to the sort of chagrin of Jim, we ousted the Blue Tones as the number one group in the area, and we started really making a name for ourselves. We got to the point in our lives when we're now, you know, 2.5 years further down the road. This now was 1963. We'd made a big name for ourselves locally, but a lot of the guys in the band, half the band, I'd say, thought of it just as a nice thing to do, and they wanted to get on with their careers. That meant to them thinking about university, whatever. It meant with me thinking about university as well. But I'd left school, and I deliberately applied too late to get into university that year because I thought, what I really want to do is be in the band and turn professional. And if I can make anything happen this year, I've got a year's grace before I then have to go to university so I can make the choice, you know. So Paul Atkinson was a year younger than me. He'd taken his A-levels and he got a place at university. And at this time, we were all thinking about, you know, breaking up. But the Hearts Beat competition, Hertfordshire was the county that St Albans is in. And this thing, the Hearts Beat competition, came up. We entered this, and Chris White and myself specifically entered this with the thought that it might be a way of persuading the others to turn professional. We didn't really organise support, but a fantastic thing happened, that from around the area, people really organised support. And we did this competition, and we had this fantastic sort of phalanx of supporters that we hadn't really organised, but were cheering for us. It was great. And we won our heat, and we won our heat playing a version we had of Summertime, which was quite jazzy, actually, much longer and jazzier than the version that we finally put onto record. That sort of created waves. And actually, we were offered a recording contract after the heat. One of the prizes for the final was a recording contract with Decca. But in fact, we were offered the recording contract after the heat, before we were in the final. We went on to win the competition, which in a way is one of the most exciting nights of my life, because the atmosphere was very heady. There were lots of people there. The support was fantastic. And we won, you know, it's absolutely fantastic. At that time, we were still doing covers, and in fact, all the things we did, as far as I remember, on the competition were cover versions of other people's songs, sometimes really heavily modified into our own style. I mean, certainly Summertime is like no other version of Summertime that I've ever heard. But by the time the Zombies were up and going, I'd written one song that we used to do in the act called It's All Right With Me, which actually made it onto the first Zombies EP. Chris had written one or two things. But when we won the beat competition, we got the recording contract and we were going to record Summertime, release it as our first record. And we actually recorded it with a couple of people, very nice couple of guys in music in this country called the Jackson Brothers, who were musicians themselves, had their own studio, but were also the sons of a quite prominent older DJ in this country called Jack Jackson. And we recorded Summertime, and Decca was going to release that as our first single. It wasn't the version that finally ended up on the record. And then a friend of Chris's father, who was in the music business, as a producer, as a musician, a writer, came to see us and said, I think they're really talented, he said to his father. But he said, I don't think you should rush into this first record. He said, I think you should get Decca to record them again in their own studios. He said, I'd like to be considered to produce them. And I think they ought to write something themselves for the session. So with a complete sort of confidence and naivety of youth, I thought, and with no knowledge at all of any of the pitfalls that happen along the way to getting a successful record, I thought, yeah, I can write something for the session and it'll be better than most of the stuff that's around, and we'll rehearse it, it'll sound great, and the recording will go great. It'll sound like a great record, it'll come out and it'll be a hit all over the world. And it was. I mean, it was just ridiculous, really. And, you know, you only get one shot at that, because after you've recorded a couple of times, you realise, you know, how the gods have to be in your favour for every aspect of the process to work, you know. I mean, the pitfalls are just enormous. The gods were smiling on us, and it actually did work. And Chris wrote for that session too. He wrote You Make Me Feel Good, which turned out to be the B-side of She's Not There. At the time, that wasn't necessarily so at all. We were all knocked out with She's Not There and You Make Me Feel Good. And so was the producer and so was everybody else. And it was a real toss of a coin as to what was going to be the first A-side, You Make Me Feel Good or She's Not There. And in the end, the toss of the coin decided it was She's Not There. Decca, first of all, weren't sure whether to release She's Not There or You Make Me Feel Good. They were excited with the session. They were excited with the results. But you have to also remember at the time, Decca were the company which, this has been said a million times, I know, but they turned down the Beatles and they were very scared at losing anything else. And they tended to take other people's excitement and opinion and run with it. Ken Jones, the producer, was very excited about the session, so they went with it. But they were excited about it. They thought it was something very unusual. I think cautiously excited would be maybe the way to describe it. She's Not There came out in the summer of 64 in England. It was an immediate hit. At the time, you know, what you have to remember is that the whole radio setup was extremely restricted in those days. In England, there were no all-day radio stations playing pop music. There were one or two outlets. As far as I can remember, there were maybe a couple of hours a week on radio that played pop music. And there were two television programmes, as I recall at the time, when She's Not There came out. One was a thing called Jukebox Jury, which was watched religiously by the nation's youth, you know, but at the same time, the panel on it tended to be celebrities and people that often looked down on pop music. We were lucky enough the weekend it came out to get our record played on that. It was only played for 25 seconds. And then the panel made up their mind, the Jukebox Jury made up their mind on it. And the other, yeah, Ready, Steady, Go was going. That was the other main one, as far as I remember. To stand a chance, really, you had to get your record on those two shows. And we were lucky enough to do that. We were also lucky enough to have a jury that week, which at least in part was quite hip. I don't remember all the members, but I do remember that George Harrison was on it. And I remember being so excited because he loved it, you know. She's Not There came on and George Harrison loved it, which the Beatles were gods to me at the time. I mean, they still are to some extent, but I mean, at that age, you know, they were really gods. They were opening up the whole world, you know. Obviously, the first stage that we had that was part of the dream coming true, which was brilliant, was the record being released and being an immediate hit in this country. That was great. I was fantastically excited that it was a hit in America. I mean, it was just unbelievable to think that we could, an English band from St. Albans could be climbing up the charts in America. It was a complete dream. It was wonderful. But I did expect it because I couldn't see any other course, you know. My eyes were blind to anything happening that wasn't just this ridiculous dream, you know. And in the early part of our careers, it happened. I mean, later, you know, we were brought up with a rude shock. But first of all, that's the way it did happen. By Christmas that year, we were booked to go over in America. She's Not There had been number one in Cashbox, two in Billboard. And we were booked onto the Murray the K show at the Brooklyn Fox. We were playing six or eight shows a day, I can't remember what, six I think, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning and going through to sort of 10, 11 at night. We only did two numbers because there were a lot of acts on the show, but at the time we were on reasonably early in the show, and the way Murray the K worked it was that when you'd done your spot, you didn't go off into your dressing room, you went to the back of the stage and formed a sort of chorus that danced about, sort of kick your legs around to the other acts or some of the other acts. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. So it was a mixed experience for me, but what was wonderful was actually hearing and getting to know firsthand the black groups that were on the show that sounded like heaven to me. Patti LaBelle was on the show. At the time, it was Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and their whole scene was doing things like Danny Boy. This extraordinary things for them to be doing, sort of Irish, big Irish songs or big numbers that ended with huge climaxes but weren't solely at all. But obviously they had wonderful voices and their heritage was the black church and soul. And Chuck Jackson was the headliner, even though we'd had number one. There's no question Chuck Jackson was the big hit in New York. And his big song at the time was Since I Don't Have You. He'd get to the part where it was, I don't have love to bring. And then he'd just stop and the whole audience would sing the choruses. It was wonderful. And the black acts on the show, which included Dionne Warwick, Benny King, the Drifters, Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, they would sing improvised backups off stage. And he'd go, I don't have anything. And they'd sing anything, anything. And it was great. But in general, it started to get very exciting, I will say. And there was a measure of adulation. And we did start to get a measure of that sort of Beatles experience whereby you couldn't venture out of the hotel without having people running after you. You'd have the sometimes quite frightening experiences of girls running after you with scissors, because the great thing then was to try and get a lock of hair, you know. When you had scissors waving at you, you know, it could be pretty frightening, actually. It is true that Tell 'Er No came out in America before the UK, because what happened, we did the follow-up session, and we were actually recording Tell 'Er No. While we were actually recording that, a phone call came through from America. It was late at night, because the time changed and everything, and someone walked in and said, there's Al Gallico on the phone, and Al was the publisher in America, dear old Al. He was on the phone saying, she's not, there's number one, you know. So it was this really... You know, it couldn't have been scripted better in a film, you know. I mean, it really was like one of the early Elvis films. You know, you cut the record and it's the next day it's number one, you know. But anyway, we're recording Tell 'Er No and She Isn't There is number one. On the same session that we recorded Tell 'Er No, we recorded several other tracks, and one of those tracks was Leave Me Be, Chris White's song, which was to become our second single in England. Now, I must say there were two things that strike me about that. One is that none of us really thought that that was the obvious single from the session, but the producer, Ken, and the record company felt it was. And one of the reasons they thought, this is the second point, one of the reasons they thought that it was, when we recorded the first session with She's Not There and the other songs, we just went in there, we wanted it to be exciting, and we just wanted to do a good reading of the songs and make a great record. People looked at things in a more calculated way for the second session. We didn't, but Ken and the record company, but particularly Ken, I think, thought, what is it that's made She's Not There successful? And in his mind, it was Colin's breathy vocals. Now, Colin's vocals were certainly one of the things that made that record very successful. But the breathiness was natural, and it wasn't artificially highlighted. On the second session, particularly on Leave Me Be, Ken tried to really emphasise the breathiness of Colin's vocals. So instead of the ingredients being natural, they were artificially emphasised, I think. There might have been a way we could have made it, you know, stronger. But nevertheless, I don't think that was the natural second single. And it flopped here. And then they released Tell 'Er No in this country. And Tell 'Er No was a hit, but a very small one. It only reached number 30. But it was the second follow-up single in America. And, of course, it was a top five single in America too. And I remember doing a tour. The tour that we did in America after the Murray the K Show was a Dick Clark tour, which was also great. And we linked up with another tour that was going around, and Little Anthony was on that tour, you know, whose record Going Out of My Head was one of my absolute favourites. You know, again, that was a knockout moment, because he came up to me and said, oh man, Tell 'Er No, that's my song, you know, I love it. Well, I mean, I suppose the impact on the chemistry of the group, of all the initial success and everything, I think with the Zombies it was basically very positive. At least, the thing was, we were together for 3 years maybe, from our inception to the time we turned professional, and that was a great time. But then we were only together for 3 years. The impact of the early professional success, I think, was basically positive. Although all the touring meant, I don't think either Chris or I really wrote while we were on the road. And all the touring meant that the actual emphasis gets changed from the more creative side of things. You might be doing one gig a week in the semi-pro days, and that's pretty close to home. And you're spending a lot of the time listening to records, being very enthusiastic, writing. The emphasis changes more to the considerations of live stuff. And in a way, that happens with everybody, and that's slightly detrimental. At the same time, we were writing, and we thought we were still writing good stuff all the time. I remember one particular song we had that everyone thought was going to be a hit here in America, called Whenever You're Ready, which did nothing anywhere. And we thought that was a pretty good record, and we thought a lot of the records were pretty good. And generally, after She's Not There and Tell 'Er No, which were two very big hits, over the next 2 years things started to slide. Really, we had one in America called She's Coming Home, which was a top 50 hit, but it wasn't a major hit, and it was very frustrating. And the frustrations really of the hits not continuing to come were what more than anything had an impact on the chemistry of the group. Because then you start to look outside and say, well, maybe we should start doing covers. We did a Dee Dee Warwick song called Gotta Get a Hold of Myself. We did Going Out of My Head. We even did a cover of My Girl, which I'd heard by The Temptations in America, loved. And that Temptations record wasn't a hit in England. And we come back and started to do like a harmony cover of their version. And as we come away from the recording session, we heard Otis Redding's version here. So, I mean, you know, we had to forget about that. But basically, it was the frustrations, really, that caused the impact on the chemistry of the group. But there was another thing, and that was also, I mean, I've done a lot of production recently, and I've had some success, and I realise all the problems involved with production, so I'm not putting Ken Jones down at all when I say this. I actually think he was a very talented producer.
Life's like that, isn't it? Only the other day I was walking in the West End and suddenly I was set upon by hordes of fans and admirers who wanted to touch my clothes. So I took sanctuary in a nearby cinema. Normally, of course, I don't go in, but that day I saw something that really moved me. I'd like to share this wonderful experience with you. It was The Sound of Music.
Your feet right now! stand up for rock and soul radio. You're listening to Bad Teeth on WFMU with your host, Spoonie. Never stop stomping your feet. This goes out to Corey. She does it right.